Taking Stock.
Brought to you by PwC. Transformation that works. With the tech to stay ahead and the know-how to act. Visit pwc.ie to learn more.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Emmett Oliver. This is the show that looks at business and politics from a wider perspective. Coming up on the show today, what if we just ignore Donald Trump and do business with the rest of the world? Economist John Fitzgerald will be telling me something about this novel idea. Are bad bosses going to be found out in the age of social media as disgruntled employees fight back? Plus, the economics of Spotify. How detrimental is it to the music industry? You can email us, of course, at takingstock@newstalk.com. Now, of course, it's been another week of tariffs in the United States. Of course, we had Micheál Martin's visit to the White House. But since then, we've also had potential tariffs, or at least threatened tariffs on alcohol. Motorbikes have been mentioned, Harley Davidson, champagne, a whole range of goods traded between the European Union and the United States. And of course, a trade war is building up with both Mexico and Canada in the meantime as well. So the picture overall is pretty bumpy and pretty turbulent. And joining me now to discuss where this might all be going and what EU and Irish policymakers might do in the future as Donald Trump ratchets up the trade pressure on them is economist John Fitzgerald. John, you're very welcome.
Hi, nice to be with you.
Now, John, we've had a lot of different strands here. There's obviously, you know, different actions against different countries. It's quite hard to put a picture overall around all of it. But I think one thing is clear, and you've been writing about this in your Irish Times column recently, that Europe and the United States, Europe may need to start looking at other plans and may need to start trading less with the US and more with other places. Do you see that being a viable option over the next few months as policymakers in Europe look around for new options?
Yes, Europe is founded on a free trade, and if the US decides to close itself off, that's a big loss for us and an even bigger loss for the US. Now, the Canada free trade deal is a beginning. The Mercosur deal we need to ratify quickly. That will take in a number of other countries. And the approach to the Pacific region also needs to be looked at. Countries like Vietnam are, in a sense, our ally. They're likely to be badly hit by US behavior, very badly hit. And even in China, the question is, do we want to put tariffs on Chinese electric cars? In Ireland, we don't, because we don't make cars, and they're good cars, and they're cheap. So greening the economy, China is... So it does raise issues about trade alliances for the future. But until now, I assumed that the US wasn't going to totally shoot itself in the foot. But it looks as if Trump is intent on it and nobody's ready to stop him. But we'll see.
Now, obviously, it's difficult for companies to reorientate themselves very quickly. So if you've been selling goods into the US for a long time and maybe into the EU as well, you know, and you're suddenly to be told, well, you should start diversifying into, as you say yourself, places like Vietnam, other parts of Asia. So is it difficult for companies to suddenly do this? And then they might also be thinking, hang on, Donald Trump might be gone in a few years and they'll have to reorientate back again to the US. So it is a difficult picture for them operationally to manage this, isn't it?
It's in particular, the really big issue for Ireland are A, corporation tax, and B, the pharmaceutical sector. Now, the pharmaceutical sector, and it was interesting that Trump, the way he phrased the issue there, it wasn't that he expected immediate impact. He suggested that if the US had taken action before, they wouldn't have set up in Ireland. But the problem is there are certain drugs which are made in Ireland for the world. And if the US, if they put a big tariff on the US, initially it could take 2 years to build a factory in the US, and then you need federal drugs agency approval, which is tricky because they want to make sure that nobody's been poisoned by the drugs. So it could take a number of years for the alternative production to start in the US. Also, if the EU retaliates with a symmetric tax on pharmaceuticals from the US, they'll continue to produce in Ireland for the rest of the world with just a smaller production in the US. And from the point of view of a pharmaceutical company, it's not just it's highly skill intensive. Do you go out and recruit people and then find in 4 years' time that actually it doesn't make sense and you're back into a different world? So for pharmaceutical companies, it's a difficult call. If you can easily move some of the production to the US, fine. But if it's going to require major investment, then it's a big risk.
Yeah. Now, another thing, this is a very much a personal view, but I'd love to get your own take on it, is that if we don't get as much FDI in the future due to the Trump administration or any successor regimes after that, maybe that's a good thing in this sense, that it forces us to look at alternatives. It forces us also to maybe accept that there's a certain ceiling on the amount of FDI we want or should take. In other words, Donald Trump may impose that discipline upon us, and we're forced to look at more indigenous alternatives and so on, which is, a lot of people have been saying this for a long time, that our dependency on the inward investment part has become too large and has had all sorts of, some ill effects. Obviously, there are massive positive effects too. So do you think that could be a positive element from all of this, that we may not get as much new projects, we may hang on to what we currently have, and that mightn't be the worst outcome?
Well, the growth in the FDI sector needed to slow. It's like move from, was it 26% of the wage bill was in foreign multinationals 10 years ago to 34% today. And it can't go on eating the rest of the economy. So it does have to slow. Now, to deliberately slow it would be bad news. But I think the point which you make about looking at developing other models is important. We have an exceptional concentration of IT skills in Ireland and also in the pharmaceutical sector. If you look at production in Europe, we're big in both of those. Like 14% of the employees in American-owned IT firms across the whole of the EU are in Ireland. Now, until now, startups in Ireland have gone to San Francisco, California, Palo Alto, looking for funding. And you have a load of skilled people. If you encourage them to, and we like Stripe, was it? Really big company worldwide now, Irish startup, moved to the US. Havoc, about 20 years ago, it did the physics of computer games. It was bought by Intel. So I think there's an opportunity to try and develop using the skilled people that are in Ireland and say, would you like to take a chance and we'll give you a hand in setting up your own company doing something skilled and interesting?
Yeah, so would that be government-led, some kind of industrial policy drive of some description?
Yeah, well, now one of the problems is that one of the reasons people go to the US is venture capital. People will take a risk on them. And these people, investors, invest in a whole range of these. So if 99 of them fail and one of them succeeds, they make money. But the other thing about the venture capital market in California is that they know other companies and they can say to you, they can make contacts for you. So it's not just as simple as saying, oh, we give them the money. We can't give them the contacts with other related companies that would help them, which are in California. So it's not an easy thing to do. But I think looking at this on a European scale, would be good. And the two areas where we have specialists, well, also medical devices. And you're seeing Irish startups in medical devices as well, possibly more than in the pharma sector, also in pharma. But I think there's an opportunity there when you have this load of skilled people in Ireland, a concentration you don't see in many other places, make use of them.
Now, John, obviously, some people listening into the two of us might say, look, we're overblowing this a little bit. As I said, there's midterm elections in next year. It's possible, we don't know, but the Democrats could storm back. Donald Trump could finish out his last 2 years, you know, as a bit of a kind of a lame duck president to some degree, because he won't have all the houses of Congress under his control and so on. And maybe things will then swing back to a more orthodox free trade kind of model if the Democrats come back in and less of this protectionism. So is there a danger of maybe over-interpreting the Trump win and maybe companies operating a bit too knee-jerk to all of this? Maybe they just need to hold their position and get through this storm.
Well, I think all companies are holding their position because they don't know, will there be 25% tariffs on EU imports in 5 months' time? Will they come in the 1st of April? It's looking more likely that they will be there in 5-6 months' time, but no certainty. But the point you make is Trump, the thing is that Trump, I don't think he expects to be re-elected for a third term. So he wants to do his own thing. But the Republicans, if he collapses the US economy over the next 2 years, they're going to lose big in the midterm election. So you could see the ground being cut from under him by his own supporters in the House of Representatives and in the Senate. The way he could collapse the US economy quickly is if he interferes with the Federal Reserve, which sets interest rates.
Sure.
Because the US is the biggest borrower. Their borrowing requirement is over 7% of GDP. Nowhere else in the OECD area is borrowing that amount. And they have a debt GDP ratio of 125%. So the people will lend them because they're US and they pay the money back. But if people believe Trump is going to keep interest rates low and have high inflation in the US, then if you lend to the US, your money's going to be worth much less in 3 years' time or 5 years' time. And that could trigger the kind of thing we saw with Liz Truss, where people wouldn't lend to Britain or at very high interest rates, which would really have a negative impact. Now, if he doesn't interfere with the Fed, he may get through 2-3 years of crazy policies without collapsing the US economy. We don't know. But the quick way of producing a disaster is interfere with the Fed.
Now, you've been an economist a long time, and most economists generally believe that free trade in net terms is better, back to David Ricardo and others, and you've been writing about this. You know, it's almost unheard of for somebody to be very virulently in support among mainstream economists into heavy protectionist policies. But Mr. Trump, President Trump, he seems to have people around him, some of them are known, others less so, who happen to believe that protectionism is a viable economic policy. Are you surprised that they have ascended to the position they have? And can you just explain for our listeners, is this a very strong minority view among the community of economists who generally would be in support of free trade and non-tariff trading? Is this an unusual position that these guys are taking?
Yes, a short answer. And Emmett, when you and I studied economics, you much later than me, the big names were in trade and macroeconomics. If you look at those who are still alive, they're all saying this is mad. So it is the academic experts are saying this is crazy. Now, he's found people to do what he wants, but that doesn't make it right. And the thing about free trade, if you move from free trade to a protectionist regime, there are going to be costs because we talked earlier about you've got to build new pharmaceutical factories in the US, you've got to build new car factories in the US. That's expensive, and it's just to sell to a US market. If you move in the opposite direction, moving from a protectionist regime to a free trade, there are costs. And you see, for example, in Germany today, Germany needs to evolve its economy away from total dependence on cars to other things. And people are losing their job in Wolfsburg. And if you look at the results for the Wolfsburg constituency in the latest German election, the hard left and the hard right did better there than on average in West Germany because people are upset. So there are adjustment costs. It's not all plain sailing, but in the long run, free trade is, if you want to have a good successful economy, it's the only game in town. But switching regimes is expensive.
Now, there has been a bit of a debate, even among your own, the community of Irish economists, about these figures, about an imbalanced trade relationship with the US. A lot of the time, Donald Trump simply looks at goods, the trade in goods, and he doesn't look as closely as the trade in services. And a lot of your colleagues have been pointing out, if you put the two together, Ireland is not running a huge trade imbalance with the US at all. Now, do you think that's a little bit naive in the sense that what Donald Trump is interested in, whether we like it or not, is manufacturing jobs? And the way he looks at Ireland is, he says they have some of our manufacturing jobs in pharmaceuticals and we want to take those back. Now, neither me nor you may agree with that view, but is that what's driving him, even though we would regard it as erroneous?
Yeah, he's going back to 18th century economics, and manufacturing is the only game in town. The fact that we have a very large number of people involved in services in US-owned companies, it's great for Ireland and it's good he's not trying to target them. Going back to, in Ireland, politicians have known for 70 years about the balance of payments, which takes account of not just the goods, but the services. The crisis in Ireland in 1956, which the government seriously mishandled, was a balance of payments crisis, which took account of both the goods and the much more limited services at the time. So And if you read any of the discussion of previous economic crisis, it's about the balance payments, which include services. He's from a different world, just looking at continent trade, because he believes the only real jobs are manufacturing. Now, I don't see his family getting involved in manufacturing. They're involved in services. That's where the Trump family make their money. So where he's got this idea that you've got to be working on a shop floor, hefting large things around to be valuable, it's a strange view.
And do you think it's a reflection of where he sees his base as, a lot of it coming through those Rust Belt states? Is that what he's looking at, saying, I want to bring jobs back to those areas, and the Europeans have some of that stuff, as he would see it? That's
definitely an issue. And I talked about it, like German jobs have moved to China because they produce cars, better cars, more cheaply, or some jobs are moving to China. Within the US in the last 40 years, Detroit was the big place in the 70s. It's a disaster, and it's gone through 40 disastrous years because the jobs moved not to Mexico or Canada, but moved to the southern US where costs were lower. So already there are a load of disgruntled people in Michigan, still elderly, who lost their jobs from having been this powerhouse of the US at Detroit. Now they're facing the same issue, that there are people in car factories who feel they're being damaged by cheaper work in Mexico or in Canada. And it's interesting how Germany dealt with the fall of the Berlin Wall. It was making cars and it was powerhouse of Europe. They realized very rapidly that the cheaper parts, assembling the cars, could be done elsewhere. And they shifted major production to Poland, Hungary, Slovakia, where costs were much lower. But they kept the high value end in Germany. And that way, they've had 30 years of success. So it is concentrating on the things you're good at. And the problem is the people who are good at software are not necessarily the people who are good at bolting on a mirror onto a car. So there are adjustment costs, and there are people who feel they're being disadvantaged. But for the greater good of the US economy, this is mad.
Yeah, and John, just one final question. I know this is probably the most difficult one I've asked you, and there's been a few I've thrown your way, but where do you think this is going ultimately? And what I mean by that is are we talking about some kind of deal at some point, maybe later in the year, between Canada, Mexico, and the US, and maybe the EU? Or is Donald Trump just going to persist with these trade wars over several years, in your view? Or is he just, as a negotiator, going in hard initially, knowing that deal will come later? There seems to be a lot of people are kind of divided on where the long-term trajectory of all of this is going. What's your own personal view?
I haven't a clue, and I don't think he has either. So he may learn from if things go wrong quickly, but if things go wrong slowly, he may not learn.
Yeah, so it depends on the depth of it all, and I suppose the reaction of markets, not just shares, but bond markets and so on as well. Okay, John, listen, thank you very much for joining us on Taking Stock. It's been a fascinating conversation. And Mr. Trump, President Trump, will provide us with lots of further ingredients to discuss later in the year, no doubt. Thank you very much for joining us on Taking Stock.
Thanks.
And after the break, we'll be talking about the power of online unions and calling out bad bosses. Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock with me, Element Oliver. Now, as you know, lots of us don't like our bosses, and some of them talk about them behind their back or at the water cooler. But there is a growing trend that employees are going one step further than that and taking to social media in large numbers to take umbrage at their employer in various ways. Is this a wise thing to do? Is it a trend or a passing fad? We're going to hear some more now because Oliver Balch has been writing about this issue for the Financial Times, and he joins me now here on Taking Stock. Oliver, you're very welcome along.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me.
Listen, we all have grouses about our bosses. We don't like what they're paying us. We want a promotion. We want to do less hours. We want to move to a new job. That's all normal. And usually it's sealed tightly up inside the company, inside the building where we work. But it has been seeping out onto social media. Can you just sketch out what you've been seeing and what you've been writing about over recent weeks?
Yeah, sure. So I came to this piece because of all that hoo-ha around Mohammed Fayed at Harrods last year and all the ghastly things that were happening in that company. So our focus was really on proper toxic behavior that occurs rather than the sort of boss who is got poor management skills and, you know, it's a bit of an arse maybe, but, you know, he's not behaving in an illegal manner, which is what happens in some of these companies. And what fascinated me was how could Fayed get away with this ghastly behavior for so long? And there's this culture of impunity, that's the word, around these charismatic, often owner founders of large companies. So Abercrombie, Mike Jeffries, Harvey Weinstein in Hollywood, James Watt, the CEO of BrewDog, the brewer that had to leave after complaints, and Ted Baker. Actually, that was also this passed our radar because of Fayed, but I made a few calls and came up with this organization called the Organized Network, who are fantastic. And they basically are helping employees that feel trapped, often women, often in low paid jobs in these really oppressive corporate cultures with kind of alpha male bully at the top, and feel impotent. And they've tried to go through the normal channels internally, you know, whistleblowing or complaints procedures. They don't get anywhere. So Organized Network is one of those, a bit like a union that employees are going to and helping them have a voice, basically, and speak beyond the structures that the companies put in place, which are frankly pretty useless when the boss at the top runs the show and everyone is bowing down to them. You can feel really impotent. And so taking social media and organizing together is
okay. So what obviously the, you know, people will be screaming at the radio saying, but what purpose is all of this? Is it to take some kind of litigation ultimately, or is it just to vent, or why would people want to do this?
I mean, they want justice. I mean, we're talking about illegal behavior that's going on. So it's not the venting, I hate my boss, which is, you know, part and parcel of what social media is there for, right? This is about taking powerful people to account before the law, if necessary, or just putting a huge amount of media pressure on them. The reputation of these companies is everything in consumer-facing brands like BrewDog or like Harrods. So it's either holding them to account or frankly, you know, having them the comeuppance of bad news stories because of their behavior. But the point is that they can't, they try and do this internally. So we spoke to a woman who, many years after the event, who worked at Ted Baker and had seen some of the kind of casual harassment and sexism that was happening there and felt uncomfortable by it. Even 4 or 5 years later, she didn't want to use her proper name. She felt she would be victimized as a problematic worker if for speaking out. So the reason they do it is to have their voice heard and break this impunity that surrounds these powerful men, and they're invariably men.
Obviously, it takes a huge amount of courage to do that, because I suppose there's often no going back. You're kind of leaping into a void. You may, you know, find yourself getting somewhere, but equally, you may get nowhere. You just don't know how the outside world is going to react and if you're going to be successful in this campaign. So there is a huge amount of risk in this, isn't there?
Yeah, definitely. There's a report out by the Institute of Business Ethics last year. And although 64% of people said that where they'd seen misconduct, they'd reported it. That left 36% that said, you know, I'm not going to speak up. And the main reason was they didn't think any corrective action would happen. Either those internal kind of systems of grievance wouldn't work. And secondly, they thought they'd lose their jobs. And frankly, that's what happened at Ted Baker. When people spoke up, they got kicked out. The attitude was, this is how it works here. If you don't like it, get lost. And when the boss runs the HR department, as he runs every other department, you're definitely at risk. And I think there's a slight difference as what's happening now. Instead of just sounding off on social media and they'll find your account, you'll be called, hauled in, you know, the legal team will be there and you'll be kicked out. Employees are getting together and organizing and publishing public letters on social media, either anonymously or with their names, normally anonymously, but that packs a lot more powerful punch, 100 employees getting together and saying, we have witnessed this harassment that is regular and part of the culture, than, oh, they're just, you know, an employee that's a troublemaker and, you know, is unhappy they didn't get promotion or something like that. So it's much more powerful the way that this more kind of organized approach to collective complaints rather than...
And Oliver, one of the tools that are being used are encrypted messaging platforms like Telegram, another one is Signal. Can you tell us anything about those and why they are more effective than the more traditional route, which might have been an X or a Facebook or whatever? Is it just the encryption that allows the anonymity, or is there something else going on there?
No, I think it's that. I think it's just the confidentiality, that the confidence that, that it gives the employee to speak up and not feel that they're going to, you know, have a tap on the shoulder from HR on Monday morning. So I think that's what that's all about. I would say that it's sort of working the other way as well. So employees are mobilizing when they don't like the politics of a company, for example. So it's not just around abusive behavior, but for example, staff at Google walked out back in 2018 because there was a sexual harassment case, but it was how the company dealt with that. They didn't like, so they walked out en masse. Nike as well, in their HQ, the way women were treated, employees walked out. So I think it's this notion of strength in numbers that we're beginning to see, and that is facilitated by Telegraph, Signal and other social media.
Yeah, I mean, certainly in my experience, that the tech companies seem to be just very leaky in terms of companies. You know, maybe that's just the nature of what the staff are doing there. But you've mentioned Google a minute or two ago. I mean, that certainly seems, but a lot of these companies, the management seem to introduce a change or a new change in practices or a new code of behavior or something, and the employees don't like it. And as you say, they get together and organize, become an activist group almost, in some ways, and maybe their names don't get out there. So that's probably going to be the most powerful, is the more people you suck into this campaign, the more powerful it's going to be. Whereas if you're an isolated worker, you could be taken out a lot easier.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the companies have tried to stop it, of course, with non-disclosure agreements. And it's interesting to see how that will pan out. It's a lot more litigation in the States, and more employees presumably are compelled to sign these. The feedback we got was that if behavior is unethical and indeed illegal, then an NDA shouldn't stand in a court of law. You should be able to speak out if you see that kind of behavior.
Now, Oliver, the other one, I suppose, is just the power and strength between employer and employee. Obviously, we're living in a full employment market where if you want a job, you can effectively get one. So at the moment, employees hold a lot of power. It's possible that if things change economically, that relationship might alter, and people might be less likely to take to social media if they know there isn't another job to jump to next. Do you think that's a possibility will sort of maybe make this less likely in the future? Or do you think people just feel strong enough that these things will happen regardless of where the leverage sits?
I think we probably shouldn't exaggerate how much it's happening. You know, we dug around a lot and we didn't find that many success cases. So I think a lot of this still stays in-house. Either people stay silent or things are resolved out of the press and it's not talked about. I mean, that's how FIRE got away with it for decades, right? And I think that will still continue regardless of the status of the labor market. One thing I would say, I think as a general observation in the labor market, is this is the problems lie less in listed companies that tend to have independent boards and kind of clearer governance structures and are accountable to investors and to others. It tends to happen in privately owned companies with a strong boss that believe that, you know, that the rules don't apply to them, and surround themselves with yes men. So pile their board full of friends and relatives. That's when it can get nasty and it can get difficult. So rather than, you know, if it is, if there, if you, as an employee, if you do have a choice where you work, I think, I mean, of course, independent businesses, privately owned businesses can be the reverse. They can be, they can live out the family values in a way that, you know, put values before profit in a way that that public companies can't. But, you know, it is something to have on your radar if there is a charismatic kind of alpha male type figure at the top of a company, that those risks might be there.
Yeah, and Oliver, what also comes across, obviously your piece, a lot of the time you're talking about quite well-known companies. You're name-checking JP Morgan, WPP, BrewDog, you know, you've got Delta Airlines in there, you've got JP Morgan as well, in terms of their specific petition about them. So Ted Baker, all of these are well-known, you know, visible kind of companies. It might be harder, I suppose, if you're in a company that's just your average small or medium-sized enterprise that obviously has a value, but for, say, like yourself, a journalist, you're probably less likely to go to your editors and say, hey, there's a petition going around about Acme widgets, you know? There is that slight, that's not your fault, of course, but I mean, there is that issue of, like, as you've just said, if they're not large businesses, will anyone really care out there?
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's true. I mean, that's the flip side of this strategy of when the formal legal or compliance mechanisms don't work and you throw yourself on sort of the publicity and reputation value. That works if it's a well-known brand. It's much harder if it's not. But I mean, I think that Organized Group, their case studies, they don't hit the news very often, but they're working. For example, they've run a campaign with disabled women that were posting videos or images. I don't exactly know what they were doing, but it was for an adult site called Fansify, and they weren't being paid. And it wasn't big money. It was like 800 quid to 2,000 that most were owed. But for a disabled woman with a low income that is obliged to, you know, try and amplify their income through something like an adult site like Fansify that most of us won't have heard of and is in a sector that, you know, is not on the radar of everyone, you would have thought that they really would struggle to get heard. But because they mobilized collectively and this outfit organized network helped them, then they got justice and they got paid. Same for night workers with G4S, another super kind of marginalized, low skill, out off the radar kind of role. And because they organized again, they managed to get a pay rise.
Now, one final one before I let you go, Oliver, is the petition where you have a large number of employees coming together to take action. It might not be about abuse, but it might be about, as you've kind of referred to, politics, or it may be about the so-called battle between the wokery. Some people see it as, other people see it as proper social protection and progressivism and so on. So do you think we're moving possibly into that direction where if somebody, a group of people, object to the boss's strategy or the kind of products they're selling or the kind of services they're offering, they might organize a petition where it's just employee X, Y, and Z. That could be quite a powerful way that this could morph into.
Yeah, no, I don't think this mechanism is only being used to hold toxic bosses to account. It will increasingly be used on a number of different issues, and it could be your political persuasion. So there's this activist in the States, a former filmmaker called Larry Starbuck, that has been targeting large companies in the Bible Belt for their LGBT policies and other woke activity. And that's his strategy. You know, as you say, some people might be in favor, some might be against. Those that are against are posting citizen journalism, he calls it, you know, posting videos of workshops and, you know, trainings inside the company to bring this, what they see as, you know, going beyond the bounds into the public space. I mean, one thing is that this is filling a space that unions used to be, right? And I think that's one of the things we're seeing as unions seem to have less power, then the job of collective action is falling to the employees themselves, to and that's being helped with these social platforms.
Yeah, I mean, if this was back in the 70s, well, a lot of these complaints wouldn't be taken because different climate. But if they were, they would have gone to the local shop steward. So, it's been diverted. I'd say some of the people, because of their generation, might not even know what the phrase shop steward means anymore because so many of these firms aren't unionized. But listen, we'll have to leave it there. Hopefully you won't be going to the Financial Times to complain about them yourself because you've got a lot of knowledge now. But I hope you won't be taking that route yourself. But thank you for walking us through what is a growing social trend. That's Oliver Balch. He is a writer with the Financial Times. And this is Emmet Oliver here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we'll be looking at the economics of Spotify and ask, is it killing the future of music?
NetCredit is here to say yes to a personal loan or line of credit when other lenders say no. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partner. NetCredit, credit to the people.
High Five Casino is the top choice for social casino gaming that's free to play. With chances to win and redeem for real cash prizes, free spin rewards, and tons of exclusive games, you can experience more High Five moments than ever before. You're going to want to high five everyone. The neighbors, the mailman, all your coworkers, of course your friends. Well, you get the point. Your High Five moment awaits at highfivecasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. Must be 21 years or older. Terms and conditions apply.
Can I go?
Okay, that of course was Taylor Swift, who was last year's most listened to artist on Spotify. Now, whether you like it or not, Spotify is here to stay, and it has come to completely dominate the music industry since launch 19 years ago, revolutionizing really how millions of people around the world access and listen to their favorite artists. But issues do persist around how much the artists are paid, how do you get on the platform, and of course there's questions around algorithms and how they're used and what dictates what new music you may be actually exposed to. So here to talk about some of the economics of Spotify and how the platform works is journalist and author Aoife Barry. You're welcome to Taking Stock, Aoife.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you along. Now, listen, it is a very dominant platform. I'm actually one of the few people who doesn't have it. I'm more Apple, but they have blasted Apple out of the universe for music streaming for quite a while. But just tell me a little bit about what are the concerns about the way it operates. And there has been one or two new books about the company that don't paint necessarily a flattering picture.
Yeah, I mean, Spotify, you know, like you're saying, was started in 2006 by two guys called Daniel Ek and Martin Lorentzon. It's a Swedish company. It was set up by these two men who were essentially from like the kind of had advertising background. So they weren't setting it up necessarily because they were these massive music fans who wanted to find a new way to disseminate music. They did want to set up a new platform. They wanted to be able to have advertising on the platform, and they hit on the idea of putting music on the platform. So since its very beginning, Spotify has both been embraced by people because it's a way of literally having millions of songs at your fingertips. I mean, at the moment, there's around 100 million songs and 6 million podcasts, if I haven't got those facts incorrect. That is a lot of content that's on there. So there's a lot of people obviously embracing it and paying money for the subscription version where you don't get any ads. But while people are embracing it, there's long been criticism and, you know, curiosity and skepticism about how much Spotify actually pays artists and kind of what the deal is in terms of, you know, how much money the artists could even potentially get from Spotify. Because when you look at the Spotify model, it isn't the case that, you know, if you're an artist and you put an album or songs on there and you get a million streams, that you get, you know, a certain, you know, amount of cents, we'll say, per stream. How it basically works is you get like a cut of the pool of the overall streams that all the artists generated over the year. So it's a little bit of a complicated system. It's not that like money goes into your bank account because you were streamed X amount of times during the year. So people have long criticized Spotify for, you know, the amount of money that it could pay and how people could potentially get that money through that system, but also because of the fact that they're not paying the artists directly. They're obviously paying their labels. And depending on the deal that you might have with your music label, depending on what type of artist you are, you might not be getting a huge amount of money, particularly if you're not one of the, you know, 200 or so artists that generates about 5 million a year from Spotify at the moment. If you're not one of the top 70 acts that generates about 10 million each, you know, you're probably one of the, you know, average bands that could potentially get a few thousand if you're really lucky, or maybe even over 100,000 if you're very lucky. So on top of that, that question about how much people get paid, there's a new book out by a journalist called Liz Pelly called Mood Machine, Spotify and the Cost of the Perfect Playlist. And it basically looks at Spotify and how it treats artists and how it basically incentivizes artists to sign up for things like its music discovery mode, where you pay money to Spotify and it will then help to promote you onto the app, which then, of course, you know, raises questions about algorithms and about what, you know, users of Spotify and listeners are getting access to. Maybe they're getting some artists being pushed towards them in ways that they didn't realize, for example. And maybe that's also pushing artists to do things like constantly have to add new content, quote unquote, onto the app rather than taking their time, you know, to write an album. And also in Liz Pelly's book, she has a really interesting couple of chapters about what's called perfect fit content. And that's something that she's been writing about over the last little while. And that's really only come to people's attention over the last couple of years. First of all, there was a lot of queries about what were called ghost artists. So people were noticing that there is artists appearing on Spotify playlists that if you Google them, you didn't know who they were. You couldn't find out any information. And what Liz Pelly and other journalists have discovered that is that these are actually part of a system where Spotify signs up to have music from companies that's essentially like stock images, but stock music to populate certain playlists, particularly chill or ambient playlists. And they do that because they basically have to pay, they can pay less royalties those compared to other bands.
Sure. Could we just tease some of that out then? And these ghost artists, which is intriguing. So do we know anything who they are? Are they just sort of pay for play type operators who don't have any profile beyond that? Or do you have any idea who they are? They sound intriguing.
They do sound intriguing. And, you know, yeah, the name is very, very interesting. You know, if you think about the idea of ghost artists, sometimes people will notice them because as what happened, they'll say, oh, there's this interesting track on this chill playlist I'm listening to. And then they'll look at the artist profile and they'll Google them and they'll notice that like the, you know, the imagery on the profile is potentially AI created. There's not a lot of kind of sense of the real artist there. And what it turned out, there's a few different examples of this. So I'll give you one example. The music writer David Turner, he discovered that artists like, you know, the likes of Brian Eno or John Hopkins, who might normally be on an ambient chill playlist by Spotify, were actually being replaced by music from a Swedish company. And this Swedish company offered a library of production music. So that's basically like the music version of stock images, and you could pay, you know, you could pay for that via subscription. So Spotify was able to pay for that by subscription. There was also the Swedish newspaper. I'm not going to butcher the name by trying to pronounce it, but it's one of the biggest newspapers in Sweden. They discovered that around 20 songwriters were behind the work of more than 500 quote-unquote artists whose content was on Spotify. And Liz Pelly even went and interviewed some of these musicians. And what I found so interesting is that it's really like this Ouroboros, like, you know, snake eating its own tail, because some of the artists that she talked to were saying, well, we're not actually earning that much money as musicians because of streaming. So now we're getting paid to make content that goes onto these chill playlists by these companies that are creating it, and that's how we're making money now. So it's kind of created a job for people because they're not getting paid enough through streaming, which is a real irony about the whole thing.
Sure. Now obviously there's the whole idea of pricing power and how much the artists, how much power they have. Obviously people like Taylor Swift have a lot of power. People at the lower end of the food chain don't. We've obviously seen some people pushing back against the streamers over the years. You know, you think of Radiohead, occasionally Neil Young gets upset and so on. But looking at their market share, Spotify, I mean, okay, you've got Tencent, which is mainly in China. Okay, you have Apple still with Apple Music, but they've fallen back a good bit. So the power of Spotify is such that, is there any leverage the artists have, or should the larger players be doing more? Are they happy just to go with them? Because that, it sounds like these smaller people you're talking about, the ghost artists and so on, they have no power. So it's going to have to come from somebody towards the top if we want to change this structure. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about capitalism and, you know how business works these days, in the sense that, you know, the power tends to be concentrated in the hands of people who don't really want to change things massively to try and benefit other people. Now, of course, Spotify you know, and the labels will all obviously say that, you know, they're there, they're doing work to try and ensure that artists can make money. And like Spotify is paying out money, and it paid, you know, out over 10 billion in 2024, which is 10 times more than what it paid in 2014 when it paid out 1 billion. So, I mean, it is paying out money, but that money is being filtered through the record labels that the artists have signed up to. And I mean, the record labels from the beginning have had a really tight relationship, as Liz Pelly details in the book Mood Machine, with Spotify. So it's in their interest to kind of have that positive relationship with Spotify and to keep things going in that relationship, and for them to make money out of Spotify too. And I do think artists, you know, do feel, and listeners do feel very, you know, not hopeless, but like powerless in many ways, that the only way they can do anything about it is to remove, if they're an artist, remove their content from Spotify so that they don't have anything to do with the company. Or if you're a listener, if you want to do something about it, perhaps your only choice is to not use Spotify or not to sign up for it. You know, like you had the likes of Neil Young setting up his own company, Pono. You know, you have people trying to do things that are, you know, to try and create an alternative to Spotify, but it's such a behemoth, it's actually really hard to fight against it. But what I did really like in Liz Pelly's book is that, you know, she says in the last chapter of the book, she details ways that users of these platforms can do something themselves to try and make, I suppose, a more collaborative and community-oriented solution to Spotify. And her solutions are quite small things. You know, they're like libraries having music lending, streaming libraries, for example, people having listening clubs, people just spreading their music out across different tech companies, like signing up to something like Bandcamp, which does have its own controversies, but it also provides more money and more ways of artists, you know, to sell their merchandise as well as music. So there's different ways of fighting back. But I think if you're looking for a solution to the issues with Spotify, to be something that's, you know, the mirror image of Spotify, so you know, that's not going to appear. The solution is going to be a completely different model to what Spotify is offering people.
Now, where do you think live music fits into any of this in this sense? Like, can that still be the exploration level where people still go and find a live artist and then they go and download their streaming content? A lot of what you're saying is going in the other direction. Is there any hope that people will still go to a club or a pub even and see a live artist? Or is it all very much Spotify not only controls the music, but even controls the newer artists? This is where you find the new talent on Spotify, not down in your local pub or club.
Yeah, I think there can be this presumption that music fans are very passive when it comes, you know, to streaming and to discovering new artists. And, you know, Liz Pelly say in her book that a lot of listeners are kind of passive, and that's why Spotify decided to do things with its chill and ambient playlists and create this perfect fit content. But I would also argue that there's a lot of music fans like myself who aren't passive and who are always eagerly seeking out new music all the time. And that does come with, like you're saying there, going to gigs, listening to bands, you know, checking out the support band, buying music magazines, reading music websites, following creators across all the different platforms. So I follow some really cool people on Instagram that are always introducing me to new music. So I think that music fans are actually really hungry for new music, for finding out more about artists. And I do see among my peers anyway, who are into music, we spend money on gig tickets. And also when we go to gigs, I'll always make an effort, if I can, to buy a record or buy a t-shirt to make sure that the money is going into the artist's hands. They're not making a huge amount of money from touring these days, particularly if they're coming across to Ireland. You know, they've got insurance, they've got to, you know, pay for the venue, they've got to pay for their travel. So it's finding these other ways of putting the money into the artist's hands. But it's not a lucrative business if you're, particularly for an independent artist, and you're not at that, you know, Taylor Swift level. It's not a very lucrative business for a lot of musicians, and you know, the money isn't getting any bigger. Spotify might be paying out more, but I don't think you'll find artists saying, oh, "I'm going to be a millionaire now because my album's being listened to on the site."
Aoife, one last question. Obviously, there's still a fair bit of portion of physical music being sold, mainly vinyl, but there are other formats as well. I mean, is that still even, I know it's still a very small part of the market, but could that put some manners on Spotify if it grows and expands?
I don't know if it really will, because I think streaming has absolutely taken over. I mean, you know, you had the CD boom, then CDs in the early 2000s, you know, rapidly took a dip because streaming took over, particularly the kind of the early versions of streaming, or thinking about services like LimeWire and things like that that emerged in the late 90s, early 2000s. And then vinyl, like you're saying there, over the last number of years, there's been a massive vinyl resurgence, and vinyl is where it's at when it comes to physical media or to physical music. Vinyl is very, very expensive right now. now. It's a lot more expensive to buy one record. It could be about 30 quid, which is, you know, at least twice what you're paying for Spotify. So I think when it comes to people affording access to music, vinyl isn't necessarily going to replace it. But I do think you see more and more people going for that physical relationship, can we even say, with music and deciding, I want to have a record collection now. And I think what you're seeing is people actually having this kind of multifactorial relationship with music. So they're going to be streaming, buying CDs, buying records, going to gigs, picking up merch. And I think that's probably the future in terms of the individual's relationships. But I don't see anything major coming down the line yet that is going to knock Spotify off its pedestal, because there's been controversy over it for many, many years and it hasn't stopped people signing up to it.
Yeah, it sounds like an interesting book that you're mentioning there, but it probably sounds like it might bounce off the company in terms of affecting what they do. But nevertheless, all we can do is disseminate the ideas that are in there. And thank you very much for talking us through. Aoife Barry is a journalist going through what Spotify and its economics mean for all of us music listeners. Thank you for joining us on Taking Stock.
Thanks so much.
Now, that's it for this week's Taking Stock. This was Emmett Oliver. I'll just remind you, the show is available as a podcast first on Friday morning on the News Talk app or wherever you go and get your podcast. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research this week was Simon Keane. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thank you for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
It's time to have your high five moment with High Five Casino, the top social casino where the action and real prizes never stop. Fun spins and big wins are right at your fingertips with over 1,000 games, including High Five Casino exclusives. High Five Casino is always free to play with free coins given out every 4 hours. Sign up today for a free welcome offer that can get you spinning and winning right away. Visit highfivecasino.com.
High Five Casino.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. Must be 21 years or older. Terms and conditions apply.